duck goose. Also, she has mastered the command form of French. She is a bit too aggressive. She likes to kick me in the shins, but I suspect that her anger comes from her father anyway. I don't think I can blame daycare for any of her faults. Mackie and Leela are still Bean's dear friends. Occasionally, we even take Bean back to the creche to stare through the gates at the children who are now playing in the courtyard. And every once in a while, out of nowhere, Bean turns to me and says, "Sylvie cried." This was a place where she mattered. Chapter 7 Bébé Olé. Warming up to the creche turned out to be easy. Warming up to the other mothers there wasn't. I'm aware that American-style instant bonding between women doesn't happen in France. I've heard that female friendships here start out slowly and can take years to ramp up. Though once you're finally in with a French woman, you're supposedly stuck with her for life. American insta-friends can drop you any time. I have managed to befriend a few French women in the time I've now lived in Paris, but most either don't have kids or live across town. I just assumed that I'd also meet some other moms in my neighborhood with kids, the same age as Bean. In my fantasy, we'd swap recipes, organize picnics, and complain about our husbands. That's how it happens in America. My own mother is still close with women she met in the playground when I was small. So I'm unprepared when the French mothers at the creche, who all live in my neighborhood and have age-appropriate kids, are practically indifferent to me. They barely say bonjour when we plop our toddlers down next to one another in the morning. I eventually learn the names of most of the kids in Bean's classes, but even after a year or so, I don't think any of the mothers know Bean's name. They certainly don't know mine. This initial stage, if that's what it is, doesn't feel like a ramp up to friendship. Mothers I see several days a week at the creche seem not to recognize me when we pass each other in the supermarket. Perhaps, as the cross-cultural books claim, they're giving me privacy. To speak would be to forge a relationship and thus create obligations, or perhaps they're just stuck up. It's the same at the playground. The Canadian and Australian mothers I occasionally meet there treat the playground like I do, as a place to mingle and perhaps make friends for life. Within minutes of spotting one another, we've each revealed our hometown, marital status, and views on bilingual schooling. Soon, we're mirroring like nobody's business. You trekked to Concord to buy grape nut cereal? Me too! But usually it's just me and the French mothers, and they don't do me toos. In fact, they barely exchange glances with me, even when our kids are sparring over sandbox toys. When I try icebreakers like, "How old is he?" they usually mutter a number, then eye me like I'm a stalker. They rarely ask any questions back. When they do, they turn out to be Italian. Granted, I'm in the middle of Paris, surely one of the world's least friendly places. The sneer was probably invented here. Even people from the rest of France tell me that they find Parisians cold and distant. I should probably just ignore these women. But I can't help it. They intrigue me. For starters, many of them look so much better than we Americans do. I drop Bean off at the creche in the morning wearing a ponytail and whatever was on the floor next to my bed. They arrive, fully coiffed and perfumed. I don't even gawk anymore when French mothers prance into the park dressed in high-heeled boots and skinny jeans while pushing strollers with tiny newborns in them. Moms do get a bit fatter as you get farther from central Paris. These mothers aren't just chic, they're also strangely collected. They don't shout the names of their children across the park or rush out with a howling toddler. They have good posture. They don't radiate that famous combination of fatigue, worry, and on-the-vergeness that's bursting out of most American moms I know, myself included. Except for the actual child, you wouldn't know that they're mothers. Part of me just wants to force-feed these women some spoonfuls of fatty pâté. But another part of me is dying to know their secrets. Having kids who sleep well, wait, and don't whine surely helps them stay so calm. But there must be more to it. Are they secretly struggling with anything? Where's their belly fat? Are French mothers really perfect? And if so, are they happy? After the baby is born, the first obvious difference between French and American moms is breastfeeding. For us Anglophone mothers, the length of time that we breastfeed, like the size of a Wall Street bonus, is a measure of performance. One former businesswoman in my Anglophone playgroup regularly sidles up to me and asks, faux innocently, "Oh, are you still nursing?" It's faux, because we all know that our breastfeeding number is a concrete way to compete with one another. A mother's score is reduced if she mixes in formula, relies too heavily on a breast milk pump, or actually breastfeeds for too long, at which point she starts to seem like a crazed hippie. In middle-class circles in the United States, many mothers treat infant formula as practically a form of child abuse. The fact that breastfeeding requires endurance, inconvenience, and in some cases, physical suffering only increases its status. You get bonus points from American moms for nursing in France, where breastfeeding isn't encouraged, and many people find the sight of it disturbing. The breastfeeding mother is regarded, if not as an interesting oddity, then as someone who is performing above and beyond the call of duty, explains a parenting guide, published by Message, the Organization for Anglophone Mothers in Paris. We expatriates exchange horror stories about French doctors who, when confronted with the occasional cracked nipple or blocked duct, blithely tell mothers to switch to formula. To combat this, Message has its own army of volunteer breastfeeding supporters. Before I delivered Bean, one of them warned me never to hand my baby over to the hospital staff while I slept, lest they defy my instructions and give her a bottle when she cried. This woman made nipple confusion sound scarier than autism. All this adversity makes Anglophone mothers in Paris feel like lactating superheroes, battling the evil doctors and strangers who like to steal antibodies from our babies. In chat rooms, expatriate mothers list the strangest places they've nursed in Paris. Inside Sacré-Cœur Cathedral, on a tomb at Père Lachaise Cemetery, and at a cocktail party at the Four Seasons Hotel Georges V. One mother says she breastfed her baby while standing and complaining at the EasyJet counter in Charles de Gaulle Airport. I sort of laid him on the counter. I pity the poor clerk. Given our zeal, we can't fathom why French mothers barely breastfeed. About 63% of French mothers do some breastfeeding. A bit more than half are still nursing when they leave the maternity hospital, and most abandon it altogether soon after that. Long-term nursing is extremely rare. In the United States, 74% of mothers do at least some breastfeeding, and a third are still nursing exclusively at 4 months. It's harder still for us Anglophones to understand why even a certain type of middle-class French mother, the ones who steam and puree organic leeks for their 7-month-olds and send their 3-year-olds to the same African drumming classes that we do, don't breastfeed much either. Don't they have the same medical information we have? One incredulous American mother asks me. Among Anglophone mothers, the reigning theories about why French women don't nurse include they can't be bothered. They care more about their boobs than about their babies, though apparently it's pregnancy, not breastfeeding, that stretches out breasts. And they just don't know how important it is. Locals tell me that breastfeeding still has a peasant image, from the days when babies were farmed out to rural wet nurses. Others say that artificial milk companies pay off hospitals, give away free samples in maternity wards, and advertise mercilessly. Olivier, who's married to my journalist friend Christine, theorizes that nursing demystifies the female breast, turning it into something utilitarian and animalistic. Just as French fathers strategically avoid a woman's business end during the birth, they avoid viewing the female breast when it's used for unsexy purposes. There are small pockets of breastfeeding enthusiasts in France, but mostly there's little peer pressure to nurse for a long time. When my British friend Allison, who teaches English in Paris, told her doctor that she was still nursing her 13-month-old, she says the doctor asked, "What does your husband say? And your shrink?" Enfant magazine, one of the main French glossies, says that breastfeeding after 3 months is always viewed badly by one's entourage. Alexandra, the mother of two girls who works in a creche, tells me that she didn't give a drop of breast milk to either of her daughters. She says this without apology or guilt. She says she was thrilled that her husband, who's a fireman, wanted to help care for the girls, and that bottle feeding them was a great way for him to pitch in. She points out that both girls are now perfectly healthy. Alexandra adds, "It was good practice for the father to give a bottle at night, and I could sleep and drink wine in restaurants. It wasn't so bad for maman." Pierre Bitun, a French pediatrician and longtime proponent of breastfeeding in France, says many French women think they just don't have enough milk. Dr. Bitun says this is because French maternity hospitals often don't encourage mothers to feed their newborns every few hours. That's critical in the first few days, so that mothers produce enough milk to feed their babies. If they don't nurse very frequently from the start, then they really don't have enough milk, and a recourse to formula starts to seem inevitable. "By day three, the kid has lost 200 grams, and they say, 'Oh, you don't have enough milk. Let's give him some formula. The kid is starving.' That's what happens. It's crazy." Dr. Bitun speaks often at French hospitals to explain the science and the benefits of breastfeeding, but "the culture is stronger than the science," he says. "3/4 of the people I work with in hospitals don't believe that breast milk is healthier than formula. They think there's no difference. They think artificial milk is fine, or at least that's what they say to mothers, to avoid making them feel guilty." In fact, even though French children consume enormous amounts of formula, they beat American kids on nearly all measures of health. France ranks about 6 points above the developed country average in UNICEF's overall health and safety ranking, which includes infant mortality, immunization rates until age 2, and deaths from accidents and injury up to age 19. The United States ranks about 18 points below the average. French parents see no reason to believe that artificial milk is terrible or to treat breastfeeding as a holy rite. They assume that breast milk is far more critical for a baby born to a poor mother in sub-Saharan Africa than it is for one born to middle-class Parisians. "We look around and see that all the babies who drink formula are fine," says Christine, the journalist, who has two young kids. "We all drink formula, too." I'm not so calm about it. In fact, I'm so panicked by my conversation with a breastfeeding consultant that when I'm in the maternity hospital after Bean is born, I insist that she stay in the room with me around the clock. I wake up each time she whimpers and barely get any rest. This suffering and self-sacrifice just seems like the natural order to me. But after a few days, I realize I'm probably the only mother in the maternity ward who's subjecting herself to this torture. The others, even the ones who are breastfeeding, hand their babies over to the nursery down the hall at night. They feel entitled to a few hours' sleep. I finally feel shattered enough to give this a try, too, even though it feels enormously indulgent. I'm immediately won over by the system, and Bean doesn't seem any worse for it. Contrary to the rumors, the nurses and puéricultrices who work in the nursery are more than happy to wheel her to my room whenever she needs to nurse, and then take her away again. France is probably never going to be ground zero for breastfeeding, but it does have the Protection Maternelle et Infantile, Mother and Infant Protection Service, the same agency that oversees the creche. This government health service has offices all over Paris that give free checkups and injections to all children until age 6, even those who are in France illegally. Middle-class parents rarely use the PMI, because the government insurance plan covers much of the cost of their visits to private pediatricians. The French government is the main insurer, but most French doctors are in private practice. I'm reluctant to use a public clinic. Will it be impersonal? Will it be clean? One crucial fact convinces me. It will be completely free. Our local PMI office is a 10-minute walk from our house. It turns out that we can see the same doctor each time we go. There's a giant indoor playground in the immaculate waiting area. The PMI will send a puéricultrice to your house, to check in on you and your baby when you get back from the hospital. If you get the baby blues, they've got an in-house shrink. All of this is free, too. There's not even a bill. It's worth weighing that against an ounce of breast milk. I'm not taking any chances about breastfeeding. The American Academy of Pediatrics says I should nurse for 12 months, so I do, practically to the day. I give Bean a final, valedictory feed on her first birthday. Sometimes I do enjoy nursing, but often I find it irritating to interrupt whatever I'm doing to rush back home for feeds or, increasingly, for a date with my electric breast pump. Mostly I forge on because of everything I've read about the health benefits, and because I want to stick it to that lady in my playgroup. All the American peer pressure to breastfeed does serve a public health purpose. It gets breast milk into our babies' mouths, but it also makes us a little crazy. French women can see that steamroller of anxiety and guilt coming from a few kilometers away, and they're at least trying to resist it. Dr. Batoun says that in his years of campaigning for breastfeeding, he's found that French mothers generally aren't won over by the health arguments involving IQ points and secretory IgA. What does persuade them to nurse, he says, is the claim that both they and the baby will enjoy it.
"We know that the pleasure argument is the only thing that works," he says.
Many French mothers would surely like to breastfeed longer than they do, but they don't want to do it under moral duress or flaunt it at two-year-olds' birthdays. Powdered milk may be worse for babies, but it no doubt makes the early months of motherhood a lot more relaxing for French moms. French mothers may be relaxed about not breastfeeding, but they aren't relaxed about getting back in shape after they give birth. I'm shocked when I find out that the skinny waitress at the cafe where I go to write most days has a 6-year-old. I had taken her for a 23-year-old hipster. When I tell her about the expression, MILF, Mom, I'd like to fuck, she thinks it's hilarious. There's no French language equivalent. In France, there's no a priori reason why a woman wouldn't be sexy just because she happens to have children. It's not uncommon to hear a Frenchman say that being a mother gives a woman an appealing air of plenitude, happiness, and fullness of spirit. Of course, some American moms quickly shed their baby weight, too, but it's easy to find role models urging women in the other direction. A new mom makeover fashion spread in American Baby magazine shows three embarrassed, still slightly chubby women smiling uncomfortably in loose-fitting dresses. They've strategically positioned their toddlers in front of their hips. The text is unapologetic. Giving birth changes your body, and becoming a mom changes your life, it says, before singing the praises of drawstring pants. For some American moms, there's something morally righteous about committing to motherhood at the expense of their bodies. It's like giving yourself over to a higher cause. A sports marketing consultant from Connecticut, who has a 6-month-old, tells me that a French woman showed up at our local playgroup recently and immediately asked the group, in what I imagine to be a charming Gallic accent, "Okay, so how is everyone losing the weight?" According to the consultant, she and the other American mothers fell silent. This wasn't something they usually discussed. Sure, they would have loved to snap their fingers and knock off 20 pounds, but none of them were losing much weight. It seemed selfish to take time away from their babies to tend to their fat, or even to talk too much about it. You won't silence any rooms in Paris by asking how new mothers lose their baby weight. Just as there's enormous social pressure for women not to gain too much weight while they're pregnant, there's similar pressure to shed the weight soon after they give birth. The sister of the sports marketing consultant is my American friend Nancy, who lives in Paris and has a son with her French boyfriend. The two sisters, who even look alike, are a kind of social experiment. Just by virtue of where they live and who their partners are, they're facing opposite social pressures. Nancy, the sister in Paris, tells me that a few months after she gave birth, her French boyfriend began needling her to stop wearing sweatpants and to shed her spare tire. As an incentive, he offered to take her shopping for new clothes. Nancy says she was both surprised and offended. Like her sister in Connecticut, she had imagined herself to be in a protected mom zone. where she got a pass on her appearance for a while so she could devote herself to looking after the baby. But Nancy's French boyfriend was working from a different script. He still viewed her fully as a woman and felt entitled to the aesthetic benefits that go with that. He was equally surprised and bothered that she was willing to just give that up. In France, 3 months seems to be the magic number. French women of all ages keep telling me they got back their ligne, figure, by 3 months postpartum. Audrey, a French journalist, tells me over coffee that she got her figure back right away after both of her pregnancies, one of which was with twins. "Of course, it was natural," she says. "You too, no?" I was already sitting down when she arrived at the café. As a foreigner who's not married to a Frenchman, I've excused myself from the 3-month rule. I'm not sure I even heard about it until Bean was 6 months old. My body has charmingly decided to store its extra bulk around my belly and hips, giving the impression that I might be holding on to at least the placenta. I'd surely be skinnier if I had French in-laws to needle me. It seems that just as obesity spreads through social networks, so does thinness. If everyone around you assumes that they're going to drop the extra pounds, you're more likely to actually do it. It's also easier to lose weight if you haven't gained too much. To lose their baby weight, French women seem to do a slightly more intensified version of what they do the rest of the time. "I pay a lot of attention," is how my friend Virginie, a svelte mother of three, explains it to me over lunch one day, as I gorge on a giant bowl of Cambodian noodle soup. Any country that France has occupied or colonized is overrepresented in cheap, delicious ethnic restaurants in Paris. Virginie says she never goes on a diet, known in French as a régime. She just pays a lot of attention, some of the time. "What do you mean?" I ask Virginie between slurps. "No bread," she says firmly. "No bread?" I repeat, incredulous. "No bread," Virginie says, with steely, calm conviction. Virginie doesn't mean no bread ever. She means no bread during the week, from Monday to Friday, on the weekends, and on the occasional night out during the week. She says she eats whatever she wants. "You mean whatever you want in moderation, right?" I ask. "No, I eat whatever I want," she says with that conviction again. This is similar to what Mireille Giuliano prescribes in French Women Don't Get Fat. Giuliano suggests taking just one day off, and even then not overdoing it too much. It's inspiring to see someone who's actually implementing this, evidently with great success. Paying attention may be another example of French women intuitively following the best science. Researchers have found that the best way to lose weight and keep it off is to carefully monitor yourself. For instance, by keeping a food diary and weighing yourself daily. They've also discovered that people have more willpower when they don't rule out ever eating certain foods, but rather tell themselves that they will eat those foods later, such as, presumably, during the weekend. I also like the neutral, pragmatic French formulation, paying attention, over the value-laden American one, being good, and its guilt-ridden, demoralizing opposites, cheating and being bad. If you've merely stopped paying attention and had some cake, it seems easier to forgive yourself and to eat mindfully again at the next meal. Virginie says this way of eating is an open secret among women in Paris. Everyone you see who is thin, she draws a kind of imaginary line down her small frame, pays very close attention. When Virginie feels like she's put on a few pounds, she pays closer attention still. My friend Christine, the French journalist, later sums up this system very succinctly for me. "Women in Paris don't eat very much." Over lunch, Virginie looks me up and down and evidently decides that I have not been paying attention. "You drink café crème, don't you?" she says. Café crème is what Parisians call café au lait. It's a cup of steaming milk poured onto a shot of espresso. Without the foam, that would make it a cappuccino. "Yes, but I use fat-free milk," I say weakly. I do this when I'm at home. Virginie says that even fat-free milk is hard to digest. She drinks café allongé, lengthened coffee, which is espresso diluted with boiling water. Filtered American coffee or tea is fine, too. I scribble down Virginie's suggestions. Drink more water. Climb the stairs. Go for walks. As if I'm receiving revelation. I'm not obese. Like my friend Nancy, I'm just sort of motherly. There's no risk of beans getting jabbed by a hip bone when I bounce her on my lap. I have skinny aspirations, though. I've promised myself that I won't think of getting pregnant again until I finish my book and reach my target number of kilograms. After years in France, I still don't know whether to wear a sweater when I hear the temperature in Celsius, or how tall someone is when they give their height in centimeters, but I immediately know whether my weight in kilograms means I'll fit into my jeans or not. Of course, French mothers aren't just different because they're thin. Not all of them are, anyway. And I meet American women who fit back into their pre-pregnancy jeans by the 3-month mark, too. But I can spot these American mothers from a distance in the park just by their body language. Like me, they're hunched over their kids, setting out toys on the grass while scanning the ground for choking hazards. They're transparently given over to the service of their children. What's different about French moms is that they get back their pre-baby identities, too. For starters, they seem more physically separate from their children. I've never seen a French mother climb a jungle gym, go down a slide with her child, or sit on a seesaw, all regular sights back in the United States and among Americans visiting France. For the most part, except when toddlers are just learning to walk, French parents park themselves on the perimeter of the playground or the sandbox and chat with one another, though not with me. In American homes, every room in the house is liable to be overrun with toys. In one home I visited, the parents had taken all the books off the shelves in their living room and replaced them with stacks of kids' toys and games. Some French parents store toys in the living room, but plenty don't. The children in these families have loads of playthings, but these don't engulf the common spaces. At a minimum, the toys are put away at night. Parents see doing this as a healthy separation and a chance to clear their minds when the kids go to bed. Samia, my neighbor, who during the day is the extremely doting mother of a 2-year-old, tells me that when her daughter goes to bed, "I don't want to see any toys. Her universe is in her room." It's not just the physical space that's different in France. I'm also struck by the nearly universal assumption that even good mothers aren't at the constant service of their children, and that there's no reason to feel bad about that. American parenting books typically tack on reminders for mothers to have lives of their own, but I frequently hear American stay-at-home mothers say they never use babysitters because they consider all childcare to be their job. In Paris, even mothers who don't work take for granted that they'll enroll their toddlers in part-time childcare in order to have some time alone. They grant themselves guilt-free windows to go to yoga class and to get their highlights retouched. As a result, even the most harried stay-at-home moms don't show up at the park looking frazzled and disheveled, as if they're part of a separate tribe. French women don't just permit themselves physical time off. They also allow themselves to mentally detach from their kids. In Hollywood films, you know instantly if a female character has kids. That's often what the film is about. But in the French romantic dramas and comedies I occasionally sneak out to watch, the fact that the protagonist has kids is often irrelevant to the plot. In one typical French film, Les Regrets, a small-town schoolteacher rekindles a love affair with her former boyfriend, who comes back to town when his mother becomes ill. During the film, we're vaguely aware that the schoolteacher has a daughter, but the little girl appears only briefly. Mostly, the movie is a love story, complete with steamy sex scenes. The protagonist isn't supposed to be a bad mother. It's just that being a mother isn't part of the story. In France, the dominant social message is that while being a parent is very important, it shouldn't subsume one's other roles. Women I know in Paris express this by saying that mothers shouldn't become enslaved to their children. When Bean is born, one of the main television channels runs a talk show most mornings called Les Maternelles, in which experts and parents dissect all aspects of parenting. Right afterward, there's another program, We're Not Just Parents, which covers work, sex, hobbies, and relationships. Of course, some middle-class French women lose themselves in motherhood, just as some American mothers manage not to, but the ideals in each place are very different. I'm struck by a fashion spread in a French mother's magazine featuring the French actress Géraldine Pélas. Pélas, 39, is a real-life mother of two who's posing as different types of moms. In one photograph, she's smoking a cigarette, pushing a stroller, and gazing into the distance. In another, she's wearing a blonde wig and reading a biography of Yves Saint Laurent. In a third, she's wearing a black evening gown and impossibly high feathered stilettos while pushing an old-fashioned pram. The text describes Pélas as an ideal of French motherhood. She is at her base, the most simple expression of female liberty, happy in her role as mother, avid and curious about new experiences, perfect in crisis situations, and always attentive to her children, but not chained to the concept of perfect mother, which, she assures us, does not exist. There's something in this text, and in Pélas's bearing, that reminds me of those French mothers who snub me in the park. In real life, they mostly aren't prancing around in Christian Louboutin heels. But like Pélas, they signal that while they are devoted mothers, they also think about stuff that has nothing to do with their kids and enjoy moments of guilt-free liberté. Pélas, of course, shed her baby weight the instant her kids came out. But that inner life, which we glimpse in the photos, and which I see in those French moms at the crèche and in the park, is also required to keep her looking and feeling seductive. Pélas doesn't look like a cartoonish MILF. She just looks like a sexy, relaxed woman. I can't imagine her telling me that she's only as happy as her least happy child. I consult my friend Sharon, who's a Francophone Belgian literary agent married to a handsome Frenchman. She's lived all over the world with him and their two kids. Sharon immediately homes in on another thing I'm seeing in the Pélas pictures and in the mothers all around me in Paris. For American women, the role of mom is very segmented, very absolute, Sharon says. When they wear the mom hat, they wear the mom clothes. When they're sexy, they're totally sexy, and the kids can see only the mom part. In France, and apparently in Belgium too, the mom and woman roles ideally are fused. At any given time, you can see both. Chapter 8. The Perfect Mother Doesn't Exist. Here's something you might not know. Spending 12 hours a day at the computer, stress eating chocolate M&Ms, does not promote weight loss. It does, however, enable me to finish my book, and the mere presence of this book on Amazon.com jolts awake the woman in me. So does the book tour. I traveled to New York, sans husband and child, to talk about the book to anyone who'll listen, and stare lovingly at it in bookstores. One salesman has seen this behavior before. He approaches me and asks, "Are you the author?" My real transformation happens when the book comes out in French. After years of having a semi-detached presence in Paris, I'm suddenly thrust into the national conversation. The book is a journalistic study of how different cultures treat infidelity. This was as far as I could get from financial writing, and it seemed like a salient topic to research from France. Americans treated the book as a serious moral inquiry. The French assumed that the book is meant to be amusing. A talk show called Le Grand Journal invites me to come on and discuss it, live and in French. I'd vaguely noticed Le Grand Journal, which is broadcast five nights a week at 7:05 p.m. My French publisher, a wizened woman in her 50s with a solid gold Rolodex, explains that the show is a French institution. It's a cross between The Tonight Show and Meet the Press. Host Michel Denisot is a legendary journalist. He and a panel of interviewers grill each guest. Everyone is witty, but a bit savage. It's like a posh French dinner party, but broadcast on live TV. My publisher is thrilled for the publicity, but she's panicked about my French. She arranges for me to spend hours fielding practice questions in French from a businessman she knows. He seems nervous, too. He keeps reminding me that affaire, in French, doesn't mean anything extramarital. For that, I need to say aventure or liaison. By the night of the show, I'm feeling immersed and ready. I have 3 cups of espresso and sit for hair and makeup. Then suddenly I'm standing behind 2 giant curtains. Michel Denisot says my name, and the curtains open. I descend the glossy white steps, Miss America style, then walk to a large table where Denisot and the 3-person panel are waiting for me. I'm concentrating so hard on understanding the questions that I'm not even nervous. Fortunately, they're most of the questions I practiced. How did I get the idea for the book? How does France compare with the United States? When one of the interviewers asks me if I was unfaithful myself while writing the book, I bat my eyes coquettishly and say that I'm a journalist. So, of course, I was très professionnel. The interviewers and the studio audience love this. On this high note, Denisot starts to wrap up the interview. He seems to be making a summary statement. I stop paying close attention. My brother, who watches a replay on the internet, says at this point I look visibly relieved. Then suddenly I hear my name again. Denisot is formulating another question for me. He can't let it rest. It's something about Moz, French for Moses, and a blog. Moses had a blog? My brother says that when the camera cuts back to me, I look petrified. I have no idea what he's asking me. All at once, I get it. Denisot isn't saying blog, he's saying blague, the French word for joke. He wants me to retell a joke from my book. It's the one where Moses comes down from the mountain and says, I have good news and bad news. The good news is that I got him down to 10 commandments. The bad news is adultery is still in there. This isn't one of the questions I had practiced. On the spot, I can't think of exactly how the joke goes, and certainly not how it goes in French. How do you say mount? How do you say commandment? All I manage to say is, adultery is still in there. The audience, gratefully, is still in a good enough mood to laugh, and Dennis so wisely moves on to the next guest. Despite this incident, I'm grateful to be in the working world again. It puts me in sync with French society. That's because after boldly not breastfeeding, then reconditioning their minds and bodies, French mothers go back to work. College-educated mothers rarely ditch their careers, temporarily or permanently, after having kids. When I tell Americans that I have a child, they usually ask, "Are you working?" Whereas French people just ask, "What do you do?" Back in the United States, I know lots of women who've stopped working to raise their kids. In France, I know exactly one. I have a vision of what my life as a stay-at-home mom would have been in France, when I ditch work one morning and take Bean to the park. Our local park was built in the 19th century on the site of the former palace of the Knights Templar. Take that, Central Park. This may sound like the Da Vinci Code, but really it's quite bourgeois. You're more likely to dig up an abandoned pacifier there than a medieval relic. There's a little lake, a forged iron gazebo, and a playground that fills up as soon as school lets out. Bean and I are in the gazebo when I'm jolted by the sound of American English coming from a woman with 2 little kids. She and I are soon exchanging life stories. She tells me that she quit her job as a fact-checker to accompany her husband on his year-long sabbatical in Paris. They agreed that he would do his research while she soaked up the city and looked after the kids. 9 months into the sabbatical, she doesn't look like someone who's been relishing the city of light. She looks like someone who's been schlepping 2 toddlers back and forth to the park. She stumbles over her words a bit, then apologizes, explaining that she doesn't often speak to adults. She's heard about the playgroups organized by English-speaking moms, but says she didn't want to spend her precious time in France with other Americans. I try not to take this personally. She speaks excellent French, and had assumed that she'd meet some French moms and buddy around with them. "Where are all the mothers?" she asks. The answer, of course, is that they're at work. French mothers go back to work in part because they can. The high-quality creches, subsidized and shared nannies, and other childcare options I'll make the transition logistically possible. It's no accident that French women are supposed to get their figures back in 3 months. That's roughly when they go back to the office. French mothers also go back to work because they want to. In a 2010 survey by the Pew Research Center, 91% of French adults said the most satisfying kind of marriage is one in which both husband and wife have jobs. Just 71% of Americans in Britain said this. Some college-educated women I know do 4/5, in which they stay home with their kids on Wednesday when there's no preschool or primary school. But the mothers I meet say they hardly know any women who opt to stay home full-time. "I know one, and she's about to divorce," says my friend Esther, the lawyer. Esther recounts this woman's story as a cautionary tale. She quit her job as a saleswoman to look after the kids, but then she was financially dependent on her husband, and thus less entitled to voice her opinions. She was withholding her feelings and complaints, and therefore, after a while, the misunderstandings got worse and worse, Esther explains. She goes on to say that there are circumstances when mothers can't really work, such as when a third child arrives. But she says any break from work should be for a limited time, say until the youngest is 2. French professional women tell me that quitting work for even a few years is a precarious choice. "If tomorrow your husband is unemployed, what will you do?" asks my friend Danielle. Hélène, the engineer with 3 kids, says that she'd really prefer not to work and to rely on her husband's salary, but she won't quit. "Husbands can disappear," she explains. French women work not just for financial security, but also for status. Stay-at-home moms don't have much, at least not in Paris. There's a recurring French image of a housewife sitting sullenly at a dinner party because no one wants to talk to her.
"I have 2 friends who don't work. I feel like nobody is interested in them," Danielle tells me.
She's a journalist in her early 50s with a teenage daughter.
"When the kids are grown up, what is your social usefulness?"
French women also openly question what their own quality of life would be if they looked after children all day. The French media has no problem describing this experience with cold-eyed ambivalence. One article I read says that for mothers, without a professional activity, the principal advantage is to see their kids grow up. But the fact of being an at-home mother brings inconveniences, notably isolation and solitude. Since there aren't many middle-class stay-at-home moms in Paris, there also aren't many weekday playgroups, storytelling hours, or mommy and me classes. The ones that do exist are mostly by and for Anglophones. There's one fully French kid in our neighborhood playgroup, but he comes with his nanny. His mother, a lawyer, apparently wants the boy to be exposed to English. I don't hear him actually speak it. The mother shows up once when it's her turn to host. She has raced back from the office, wearing high heels and a business suit. She looks at us Anglophone mothers with our sneakers and bulging diaper bags, like we're a bunch of exotic animals. American-style parenting and its accoutrements, the baby flashcards and competitive preschools, are by now cliches. There's been both a backlash and a backlash to the backlash. So I'm stunned by what I see at a playground in New York City. It's a special toddler area with a low-rise slide and some bouncy animals separated from the rest of the park by a high metal gate. The playground is designed for toddlers to safely climb around and fall. A few nannies are sitting French-style on benches around the perimeter, chatting and watching their charges play. Then a white, upper-middle-class mother walks in with her toddler. She follows him around the miniature equipment while keeping up a non-stop monologue. "Do you want to go on the froggy, Caleb? Do you want to go on the swing?" Caleb ignores these questions. He evidently plans to just bumble around. But his mother tracks him, continuing to narrate his every move. "You're stepping, Caleb," she says at one point. I assume that Caleb just landed a particularly zealous mother. But then the next upper-middle-class woman walks through the gate, pushing a blonde toddler in a black T-shirt. She immediately begins narrating all of her child's actions, too. When the boy wanders over to the gate to stare out at the lawn, the mother evidently decides this isn't stimulating enough. She rushes over and holds him upside down. "You're upside down!" she shouts. Moments later, she lifts up her shirt to offer the boy a nip of milk.
We came to the park! We came to the park!
She chirps while he's drinking. This scene keeps repeating itself with other moms and their kids. After about an hour, I can predict with total accuracy whether a mother is going to do this narrated play simply by the price of her handbag. What's most surprising to me is that these mothers aren't ashamed of how batty they sound. They're not whispering their commentaries. They're broadcasting them. When I describe this scene to Michel Cohn, the French pediatrician in New York, he knows immediately what I'm talking about. He says these mothers are speaking loudly to flaunt what good parents they are. The practice of narrated play is so common that Cohen included a section in his parenting book called Stimulation, which essentially tells mothers to cut it out. Periods of playing and laughing should alternate naturally with periods of peace and quiet, Cohen writes. You don't have to talk, sing, or entertain constantly. Whatever your view on whether this intensive supervision is good for kids, it seems to make childcare less pleasant for mothers. Just watching it is exhausting, and it continues off the playground. We might not stay up nights worried about how to keep our whites whiter, but you can bet we're losing sleep over why little Jasper isn't yet out of diapers. Katie Allison Grandjou writes on Babbel.com. She describes a mother she knows with an MA in biology who spent the previous week, the whole week, teaching her child to use a spoon. That biologist surely questioned her own sanity, too. We American mothers know that parenting this intensively has its costs. But like the parents who asked Piaget the American question, how can we speed up the stages of a child's development? We believe that the pace at which our kids advance hinges on the choices we make and on how actively we engage with them. So the cost of not spoon training or narrating a trip down the slide seems unacceptably high, especially when others are doing it. The standard for how much middle-class mothers should engage with their kids seems to have risen. Narrated play and intensive spoon training are expressions of the concerted cultivation that the sociologist Annette Leroux observed among white and African-American middle-class parents. These parents see their children as a project, Leroux explains. They seek to develop their talents and skills through a series of organized activities, through an intensive process of reasoning and language development, and through close supervision of their experiences in school. My decision to live in France is arguably one giant act of concerted cultivation. My project is to make my kids bilingual, international, and lovers of fine cheese. But at least in France, I have other role models, and there are no gifted kindergartens. In America, doing concerted cultivation doesn't feel like a choice. To the contrary, the demands seem to have crept upward. A friend of mine who works full-time complained to me that she's not just expected to go to her daughter's soccer games, she's also supposed to attend the practices. Elizabeth, a French mother living in Brooklyn, was surprised that American parents were so invested in their children's success at sports. She writes that she had to repeatedly change the date and time of her 10-year-old's birthday party to accommodate the match schedules of his American friends. Each American mother described her own child's presence at the match as indispensable and claimed that without him or her, they might lose. The American push to excel often begins before kids can walk. I hear about a mother in New York whose 1-year-old had at-home tutors in French, Spanish, and Mandarin Chinese. When her child was 2, the mother dropped the French but added lessons in art, music, swimming, and some sort of math. Meanwhile, the mother, who'd quit her job as a management consultant, was spending most of her time applying to 2 dozen preschools. Such stories aren't just the province of a few extreme New Yorkers. On a trip to Miami, I have lunch with a particularly sane American mother I know named Danielle. I had thought that if anyone could resist the lure of the frenetic family, she could. She's level-headed, warm, and in a city where people tend to closely follow trends in jewelry, decidedly non-materialistic. She spent part of her childhood in Italy, speaks 3 languages, and is generally comfortable in her own skin. She also has an MBA and a resume full of high-powered marketing jobs. Danielle dislikes overzealous parenting. She's horrified by a mother in her neighborhood whose 4-year-old son already takes tennis, soccer, French, and piano lessons. Danielle says this mother is extreme, but simply having her around makes everyone anxious. You start thinking, this kid's doing all that stuff? How is my kid going to compete? And then you have to check yourself and say, that's not the point. We don't want him competing with someone like that. Nevertheless, Danielle has found herself sliding into a practically nonstop schedule with her own 4 kids. The youngest are twins. In a typical week, her 7-year-old, Juliana, has soccer on Tuesday and Thursday afternoons, communion class on Wednesday, brownies every other Thursday after soccer, and a playdate on Fridays. Once Juliana gets home, she has 2 hours of homework. Last night she had to write a folk tale, she had to write a mini essay on how Martin Luther King changed America, and she had to study for a Spanish test, Danielle says. Recently, Juliana said she wanted to take an after-school ceramics class, too. And me, feeling guilty because there's no art at the school, said, okay, let's do ceramics. The only day she had free was Monday. Juliana's whole week is now booked, and Danielle has 3 other kids. The logistics of making sure everyone gets to where they need to be at the correct time has been the best use of the skills I acquired in operations management class in business school, she says. Danielle acknowledges that she could simply cut out all these activities, except for soccer. Her husband is the coach. But what would her kids do at home? She says there'd be no other children around in the neighborhood, since they're all out doing activities too. The net result is that Danielle hasn't gone back to work. I always thought that when my kids got to elementary school, I could get a full-time job again, she says. Then she apologizes and rushes off to her car. The fact that the French state provides and subsidizes childcare certainly makes life easier for French mothers. But when I get back to France, I'm struck by how French mothers make their own lives a lot easier, too. The French equivalent of a playdate is that I drop off Bean at her friend's house, then I leave. My Anglophone friends assume I'll stay the whole time. French parents aren't curt. They're practical. They correctly assume that I have other stuff to do. I sometimes stay for a cup of coffee when I return for the pickup. It's the same at birthday parties. American or British mothers expect me to stick around and socialize, often for several hours. No one ever says it, but I think part of why we're there is to make sure our kids are comforted and okay. But by the time a child is 3, French birthday parties are drop-offs. We're supposed to trust that our kids will be okay without us. Parents are usually invited to come back at the end for a glass of champagne and some hobnobbing with the other moms and dads. Simon and I are thrilled whenever we get invitations. It's free babysitting, followed by a cocktail party. In France, there's an expression for mothers who spend all their free time schlepping their kids around, maman taxi. This isn't a compliment. Natalie, a Parisian architect, tells me that she hires a babysitter to bring her 3 kids to all their activities on Saturday mornings. She and her husband go out to lunch. When I'm there, I give them 100%, but when I'm off, Natalie tells me. Virginie, my diet guru, gets together most mornings with a group of moms from her son's elementary school. I join the group one morning and mention extracurricular activities. The temperature at the table immediately rises. Virginie sits up and speaks for the group. You have to leave kids alone. They need to be a bit bored at home. They must have time to play, she says. Virginie and her friends aren't slackers. They have college degrees and nice resumes. They're devoted mothers. Their homes are full of books. Their kids take lessons in fencing, guitar, tennis, piano, and wrestling, weirdly called catch in French. But most just choose 1 activity per school term. One of the moms at the cafe, a pretty Zoftic publicist, like me, she's trying to pay more attention, says she stopped sending her kids to tennis lessons, or anything else, because she found the lessons constraining. Constraining for whom? I ask. Constraining for me, she says. She explains, you bring them, and you wait for an hour, then you have to go back and pick them up. For music, you have to make them practice at night. It's a waste of time for me, and the children don't need it.
They have a lot of homework. They have the house, they have other games at the house. And there are two of them, so they can't get bored. They're together, and we go away every weekend.
I'm struck by how these small decisions and assumptions make daily life different for French mothers. When they have moments to spare, French mothers pride themselves on being able to detach and relax. At the hairdresser, I tear out an article from an issue of French Elle in which a mother says that she loves taking her two boys to the old-fashioned merry-go-round near the Eiffel Tower. While Oscar and Leon try to catch the wooden rings, I spend 30 minutes in pure relaxation. I usually turn off my cell phone, and I just space out while I'm waiting for them. It's like a deluxe babysitter. I know that merry-go-round well. I usually spend my half hour there waiting to wave at Bean each time she comes around. It's no coincidence that so many French mothers seem to parent this way. The let-them-be principle comes straight from Françoise Dolto, the patron saint of French parenting. Dolto very clearly argued for leaving a child alone, safely, to muddle about and figure things out for herself. "Why does a mother do everything for her child?" Dolto asks in The Major Stages of Childhood, a collection of her remarks. "He's so content to deal with things himself, to pass the morning getting dressed by himself, to put on his shoes, so happy to put on his sweater backwards, to get tangled up in his pants, to play, to rummage around in his corner. So he doesn't go to the market with his mother. Well, too bad. Or even better." On Bastille Day, I take Bean to the grassy field in our neighborhood park. It's filled with parents and their young kids. I'm not narrating Bean's play, but I don't really expect to have a chance to read the three-week-old magazine that I brought along for myself, along with a giant sack of books and toys for her. I spend a lot of the day helping her play with the toys and reading to her. On the next blanket over is a French mother. She's a thin, auburn-haired woman who's chatting with a girlfriend while her year-old daughter plays with, well, not much of anything. The mother seems to have brought just one ball to amuse her daughter for the entire afternoon. They have lunch, and then the little girl plays with the grass, rolls around a bit, and checks out the scene. Meanwhile, her mother has a full adult conversation with her friend. It's the same sun and the same grass, but I'm having an American picnic and, voila, she's having a French one. Not unlike those mothers back in New York, I'm trying to cheer Bean on to the next stage of development, and I'm willing to sacrifice my own pleasure to do that. The French mom, who looks as though she could buy a fancy handbag if she wanted to, seems content to let her daughter awaken all by herself, and her little girl evidently doesn't mind at all. All this goes a long way toward explaining the mysteriously calm air of French mothers I see all around me. But it still doesn't tell the whole story. There's a crucial missing piece. That ghost in the French mothering machine is, I think, how French women cope with guilt. Today's American mothers spend much more time on childcare than parents did in 1965. To do so, they have cut back on housework, relaxing, and sleeping. Nevertheless, today's parents believe they should be spending even more time with their kids. The result is enormous guilt. I see this when I visit Emily, who lives in Atlanta with her husband and their 18-month-old daughter. After I've been with Emily for a few hours, it dawns on me that she has said, "I'm a bad mother," a half dozen times. She says it when she caves into her daughter's demand for extra milk or when she doesn't have time to read her more than two books. She says it again when she's trying to make the little girl sleep on a schedule and to explain why she occasionally lets her cry a bit at night. I hear other American moms say, "I'm a bad mother," too. The phrase has become a kind of verbal tic. Emily says, "I'm a bad mother," so often that, though it sounds negative, I realize that she must find the phrase soothing. For American mothers, guilt is an emotional tax we pay for going to work, not buying organic vegetables, or plopping our kids in front of the television so we can surf the internet or make dinner. If we feel guilty, then it's easier to do these things. We're not just selfish, we've paid for our lapses. Here, too, the French are different. French mothers absolutely recognize the temptation to feel guilty. They feel as overstretched and inadequate as we Americans do. After all, they're working while bringing up small children. And like us, they often aren't living up to their own standards as either workers or parents. The difference is that French mothers don't valorize this guilt. To the contrary, they consider it unhealthy and unpleasant, and they try to banish it. "Guilt is a trap," says my friend Sharon, the literary agent. When she and her Francophone girlfriends meet for drinks, they remind each other that the perfect mother doesn't exist. We say this to reassure each other. The standards are certainly high for French moms. They're supposed to be sexy, successful, and have a home-cooked meal on the table each night. But they try not to add guilt to their burden. My friend Danielle, the French journalist, co-authored a book called The Perfect Mother Is You, La Mère Parfaite, C'est Vous. Danielle still remembers dropping her daughter off at her crèche at